Welcome to the Amazon Legends Podcast, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became powerful sellers, also experts specializing in helping sellers, and both former and current Amazon employees who will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here's your host, Nick Urison.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today is someone you definitely want to hear from because he's been part of building one of the largest companies in the world. In addition, he now works for an aggregator. So any one of the sellers out there listening, you want to sell your business one day, here is the man. So with that, let's get into it. So he led international expansion at WeWork. To the extent that he was once on the road, my notes tell me 340 days.
That's correct.
I'm not sure if he's single. He's still single, but I'm sure that didn't help at the time. So he transitioned to VP of Growth at Unibrands, which is an aggregator. And when he's not working, he likes to run. So and so far, he ran 6 major marathons around the world. With that, everybody, meet my guest, Mark Goldfinger. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you so much, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm glad we finally got to do this.
So, So it's been a long time. We've been working at it. So, first, let's get this off the table. So are you still single or are you married?
So I'm happily married. I got married in March of 2022.
Oh, congratulations. So
it's, thank you so much.
It helped you to get off the road, I guess, right?
It definitely helped to get off the road. It was hard to do a relationship while on the road, that's for sure.
All right, cool. Okay, so let's jump into this because I want everybody to hear the things that you're going to share with people. So what makes a brand attractive for an aggregator to be interested?
It's simple. They have to want to be acquired.
And what makes them, I mean, everybody wants to be acquired, but, you know, not everybody can be acquired. So what is the secret? Well, not necessarily secret, but what is the right way to approach this?
Well, I think the founder has to really know what they have to offer. They have to know that they have a strong USP, so a unique selling proposition. They have to know that they have year over year growth and strong momentum. They don't want their brand to be too seasonal, strong reviews, things like that.
Okay. So those things that you said are things that come up. So let's now dissect that a little bit because we want to define what is good, what is not so good, and what is average and what is exceptional. So unique selling proposition, I guess, you know, that goes without saying. So they have to have something. But for an aggregator, give us some examples of what are some USPs that you find extra interesting.
Yeah, of course. So there's a lot of brands out there on Amazon, right? And what I would actually say is there's even more products or ASINs out there. And then it gets narrowed down into a brand. Is this something that consumers are going to go look for? If they see this brand compared to another brand or another product that sell the exact same thing, which item are they going to purchase? We want to make sure that when we are acquiring a brand, that it has something strong. It has something that the consumer, the end user can relate to. Why are they going to purchase this one over something else?
Okay. So by the way, I don't know if you know this, but last time I did a little a presentation about Amazon Universe, 660,000 brands on Amazon Brand Registry.
It's a lot of brands out there.
Owned by 440,000 sellers.
That's impressive.
Yeah, that's, and it's, of course, and these numbers, of course, are outdated at this point. When I did the whole study, it was last year, that's 2022, like middle. And it was in one of Amazon reports. So the other thing that you mentioned is the seasonality aspect. Mm-hmm. So I am assuming that you don't like seasonal.
We don't dislike seasonal, but we want to make sure that as we continue to build out a really strong portfolio of strong brands, that not everything is going to come in Q4 sales, right? With all the supply chain issues, with all the inventory management, with all the operational aspects, if you have all of your brand as revenue coming in Q4 and something happens and you miss that or you get delayed by a month, all of a sudden the entire year can go the other way. And that's not going to be great for anyone's business. So as we're constantly looking and evaluating brands, we want to make sure that the revenue is somewhat consistent throughout all 12 months. Now, you also have products or brands that are very summer seasonality. And that's also okay. Because as a buyer, if we are looking to make sure that our portfolio is diverse, we are naturally going to have brands that have higher sales in the summer and higher sales in the winter. But as long as it's not a fully one way or the other, you should be in a fairly good position.
So what about situations where you have a seller account, because you have two different things here, right? So you have the seller account and you have the brands. And a brand is on its own, it has its own product lines. So a seller can have multiple brands. What if a seller has one brand that pretty much covers winter and fall and another brand that covers summer and spring?
The first thing I would say is then it looks like they're pretty, they're in a secure spot for all four seasons. The second thing I would then ask is, are they looking to sell both brands?
I see. So when you are acquiring, you are just acquiring the brand. You're not acquiring the seller account necessarily.
We're taking on everything. We've done asset deals at Unibrands and we've also done share deals at Unibrands.
Okay. So this is a bit of a different question. However, it's essential. So typically when sellers create these brands, they have a seller account. And then that seller account is registered in the name of an LLC, and then the LLC owns the brand. So if they have multiple brands, there are certain scenarios where they may want to sell one brand but retain the other. So what are some best practices for sellers to be able to build? Would you then recommend multiple seller accounts? How would that work?
I'm not the expert in how someone should set up their seller account, so I don't want to give anyone false information or false advice. What I would recommend is if someone is building out multiple brands on the same account, they make sure to really keep all the financials in very good form for each specific brand. So that way, should they want to go out and sell one or two of the multiple brands that they have, they can very easily hand over to the potential buyer, or should they choose to work with a broker, they can hand over that information and not have everything be convoluted. The issue or a big mess that we see as we deep dive and do our due diligence is that the financials can be all over the place. And then all of a sudden, we're not really sure what we're looking at. And that's where things get very complicated and messy.
Yes. I mean, you just hit the nail on the head as the one of the biggest problems, that because these sellers typically are very visionary entrepreneurs, and then they come up with product ideas and then they create these brands and they're driving sales. And the next thing is that the books are all over the place, and you come in, they have created value, but really you can't understand the real value of what they built.
Exactly.
So it's a big deal. So anybody listening, this is a huge tip. Keep your books in order, but most important, you need to create your accounting in a way that will separate out the performance of your each brand. So that way, somebody like Mark comes along and says, okay, we like what you've done. Let's take a look at it. Then you can say, here it is. This is what each brand does. So that's the goal, right?
Exactly. Look, the cleaner the brand's financial performances, the easier our investments and integration team can evaluate it and make sure that we're paying a very fair and exciting price for you and for all the hard work that you as a founder have done. As you even mentioned, Nick, right? Like, these are entrepreneurs, these are visionaries, these are people that want to build things. And then they bring it to a certain point where they don't want to build it anymore and they want to change their focus. They should still be paid out a great value for what they built. That's where we come in. We can help take it and bring their brand even further to a new height, pay them, let them go back to doing what they want to do. They then create another brand. We then buy that brand. We bring that to a new height. And thus the circle continues.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's the great ecosystem, because you guys are good at scaling something. And at the same time, these sellers are good at creating things, but
exactly,
not necessarily scaling. So it's the perfect ecosystem. Okay, so you mentioned also reviews. So tell us about reviews. I know there isn't one single answer. The answers are always relative to category and things like that. So what makes it an attractive brand in terms of the reviews?
Of course. So, you know, I combined reviews and ratings into one section, right? So when we're looking at reviews and ratings, we want to make sure a single ace in or the brand as a whole is going to be well over 4.2 stars. And typically has at a minimum over 4,000 reviews, but typically we like to see reviews that are in the 10,000 plus range, right? Any of these products that have strong reviews and strong ratings are most likely going to also have a very strong USP to it. And they're going to have a reason that people continue to come back and purchase those brands. So when you have those types of products and your reviews are strong, your ratings are strong, your USP is strong, you have a high margin, that is only going to help contribute to us paying a better or a higher multiple for your brand.
Okay. So the numbers that you mentioned are pretty high, but they are not necessarily common in all the categories.
No, they're not common. And they're also, it's important to know that it doesn't have a brand. We want it to check as many boxes as possible when we're looking to acquire it. But these boxes, as I always tell people, they're guardrails. They're to help us narrow down from the 600,000 plus brands that you set out there. These guardrails help us narrow it down to find the brands that we really do want to acquire. Once we see these, then we start speaking with founders and we can understand what works, what doesn't work. What have they been doing well? What do they need help on? Where can we come in and really help evolve the brand? And that's how we get there.
Mm-hmm. And as far as categories, so are you as Unibrands category specific, or are you open to any?
So at Unibrands, we focus on 8 specific verticals. We break them down into consumables and durables. So you think about it, we go juvenile and baby, garden and outdoor, sports and fitness, lifestyle, arts, home and culinary. And then we have personal care, pet care, home care, and supplements.
And would you have a favorite out of those or not? They're all equally the same.
My favorite is when I find a brand that I think fits into multiple categories.
Oh, I see. So multiple categories. That means it's just single brand that has products in multiple categories.
It could be, or it could be a brand that I could argue with our head of investments that this could be in the lifestyle category, this could be in the garden outdoor category, or this could be in the sports and fitness category.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you think about it, garden and outdoor and home and kitchen, they are fairly close to each other.
Exactly.
You could have and brand covering those. Okay. Right. All right. So let's get into the numbers a little bit. Okay. So as far as, again, what looks attractive to you, what is the price point of the products that you prefer?
So I would say the average order value of brands that we're looking to acquire typically have an AOV of somewhere between $25
to $75. $25 to $75. And what kind of margins are you looking for the brand to be?
Typically, we're looking at between 20 to 30% margin. Supplements are going to be on the higher end there. Some of the other brands that we'll look at might be between 20 and 23%. But ideally, we're trying to find brands that are 20% plus margin.
So let's define the margin, because that's different for everybody. So first of all, you have the top line, you know, $25 to $75, whatever the price of the item. What should they be purchasing the item for, landed?
It's going to vary between every different product, where the distributor is, what their COGS are. Like that's a tough question to give a specific answer on.
So now going by, working backwards from the 2023. So we know that we have 15% that Amazon takes, right?
Right.
So you have then the FBA fee.
Yep.
Depending on, of course, if it's bigger the item and the lower the price of the item, the higher the percentage. So
of course,
I always recommend try to pick smaller items, not very heavy, and make sure that your price is more around like $38. So if you do that, so Amazon's minimum FBA fee, I think, has become now around $5.
Something around there.
Yeah. So when you do that, then that also takes away, say, 15%.
Yeah.
So it's that FBA is 15%. So you have 15 Amazon, 15 FBA, it's 30.
Yep.
Now, we know that we're going to have advertising. So let's say it's optimized running. Best case scenario, say 15%.
Yeah, I think that's so about that.
Now we are up to 45.
Yeah.
So add the 20% that you would like to see. So
right, you're at 65, 70, and then you have COGS.
Yeah, so that leaves you with really no more than 35, because let's face it, spending 15% of the sales on ads,
you're going to spend a little more.
Yes, you're going to spend a lot more. So really, I just want to break this down, because, Mark, most sellers don't make these calculations. So what they do is they say, okay, let's come up with a great idea. Let's sell it cheap and then make money on turnover. And then it just doesn't work, right?
Yeah, that's very true.
So every sales needs to stand on its own feet.
Agreed. So, and working backwards, I think, like we just did, is a perfect easy exercise for first-time founders who are trying to put this into an Excel spreadsheet as well, right? They break it down just like that. What are their Amazon fee costs? What are their FBA costs? What are their advertising costs? What are their landed COGS? And then from there, what kind of pricing structure can they put in place to ensure that they still have a strong margin?
Yeah. So there is a funny thing here that I want to share with you that I see from time to time. So when I take on a client, this is the first thing we do. So I call it the revenue model. So I have a template and you plug in these numbers and it color codes which ones are good, which ones are not good margins. So based on that, we simply say, okay, this is not good to sell as a single item, but create packs, then that may make sense. So we start there. Now, it's one thing to plan it that way, but then their accounting needs to be set up in exactly the same format where you have these individual buckets, right? So the cost of goods sold, and then the Amazon fees bucket, and the the FBA fee bucket, or the shipping fee bucket,
right?
And advertising bucket. They are all over the place. They are posting them all. So there is no way to monitor.
Yeah.
So do you ever come across sellers who kept their books that way, so you can't really tell what is what?
Absolutely. And one of the first things that our investments team does is they'll get access to the Seller Central account with permission, of course. And then they will download the different seller business reports. They'll look through the financials. They'll look through all the P&Ls that they have. And they'll completely rewrite a P&L for that founder in a way that we can easily digest it, put it into our investment model, and start to really work from there.
I see. And how about the cost of goods sold as far as the purchase of the...
We'll break it down as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that the seller has to provide for you. Because
of course.
Yeah. Okay. So now we identified the margins. Let's talk about now the traffic. What is an attractive investment for you into purchasing a brand in terms of how they generate their traffic?
What do you mean?
Like, for example, I had one of the online marketplaces for acquiring sellers, and they were giving that as a criteria, diversity of the traffic. So if your traffic is kind of, for example, if 80% of your traffic is coming from PPC versus 30% and the rest comes from external traffic and things like that, that was the approach they had.
I would say for us, we don't necessarily look at like what the breakdown of traffic is. We obviously look to see what the spend on PPC is. We look to see how optimized the listings are. We want to see where your adverts are. Is it organic growth versus non-organic? Is it paid? But outside of that, we don't necessarily have to have, my team doesn't say, okay, well, you only had 25% organic growth or organic traffic, excuse me. So therefore, like, we're not going to evaluate you because you don't have 40% organic traffic. For us, those are things that if they are unoptimized, it's almost more exciting because our commercial team has additional levers that they can pull once we do acquire the brand, should we choose to then grow it further.
Mm-hmm. I see. So this highlights something that in one of the previous episodes came up. A brand that started building their revenue base and they're doing fine, their margins are fine, the metrics are okay, but they haven't really done as much as they could. Okay. Versus a brand that has done a great job driving, first of all, optimizing their PPC and then creating a following and building their external traffic, their influencers, whatever the case may be. Between the two, which one is more attractive to you?
It's hard to say which one because there's so many more details that go into a brand. But I like a brand where we can see a lot of opportunity and growth under us at the helm is going to be very exciting for us.
Yeah.
Right. Our goal and our promise is to grow brands 20, 30, 40% year over year.
Okay. So this is what the other guest said. So if he basically said that when I see a brand doing really well there in all the channels and doing it, there isn't much we can do. So therefore, we are not going to really find that as attractive as somebody else where we see a lot of growth opportunities.
Exactly. If something's completely optimized and there's little that we can do to, you know, grow margin there, it's going to be tough for us to say, okay, well, we're going to pay a high multiple for this brand, knowing that we might not be able to take it to another, you know, 20% growth.
Yeah. So this is actually encouraging for the sellers because sure, they don't have to really do much. So it is definitely within their reach. What they need to do is just validate their business model, validate their product, mm-hmm, and then collect reviews, and then make sure that your operation is running with healthy margins.
Yep.
And, you know, you are already there. So you are already going to look attractive.
I agree with that.
If you don't have, let's say, influencers, if you don't have your Google ads, your social media running very well, it's okay.
Because, of course.
And that's where the opportunity is.
I think that's very well said.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So now the $6 million question, the valuation, right?
Of course. Everyone wants to know what we'd value their company at.
Yeah. So what is the formula for valuing your business?
We do it based on a multiple of adjusted EBITDA or SDE, seller discretionary earnings.
So in that valuation, what are some numbers you can share with us? First of all, let's break it down. What should be the business volume? What should be their revenue that they are generating?
Typically, right now, I would say our sweet spot is between $4 to $9 million. Earlier, we acquired brands that were smaller in terms of revenue, between $2 to $4 million, and we've acquired quite a couple brands that were $15 to $25 million plus in revenue.
But your sweet spot is between $4 to $9 million.
I think right now that's what we're focusing on.
Okay, and what is the we already covered, you want about 20% margin net. Mm-hmm. So what would that brand be worth?
I mean, you're looking at adjusted EBITDA. We want to see no less than $750,000, if not $1 million in EBITDA. And then you can't just give a multiple and say, okay, well, you're operating at 22% margin, so here's a 4x multiple, right? That's not how it works. We want to understand, again, the USP, which is something we validate, the review moat, the ratings, your average order value. How many SKUs do you have? Is your manufacturer or distributor in the US or are they based in China? How much seasonality is coming into the brand? What is your COGS? What are your tacos? How are, like, what's your PPC like? All of these different metrics go into our giant formula that we're looking at. And then only from there can we assess if we're going to give you a 3x multiple, a 3.5x multiple, a 4x multiple. Are there earnouts involved? It's so hard to just say, okay, well, you run a $6 million company at a 27% margin, therefore, I'm going to give you a 4x multiple. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. So you mentioned a few things that will impact this. So if their manufacturing is US versus China, how does that impact the valuation?
A domestic brand for us, or a brand that is manufactured in the US, has a strong USP to it, right? It's, we don't have to worry if things happen overseas, if ports get full. There's different aspects there that we could value a little bit higher. That being said, there are pros and cons to have it, or there are pros to having products come overseas as well.
Okay. As far as the discretionary part, what are some, so let's say that you have the margin of 20%, make it round. What are things that will adjust that further?
Give us some add backs, salary to the CEO or to the executive team, how many full-time employees they have. Are they putting their car on their discretionary earnings? What kind of bills are they adding into the business? Things like that.
Okay. So do you like those operations that have employees, payroll employees versus outsource? Which one is more effective?
Typically for us at Unibrands, we're looking for businesses that have less than 5 full-time employees.
Less than 5 full-time employees. And then the rest can be outsourced.
Of course. For VAs, absolutely.
All right. And contractors. How about debt? How does debt on the books impact this?
We look at everything. We would look to see how much debt there is, what the time frame is, what's the interest rate. And then we would start to speak with them and see how they plan to pay it off. And we would take that into consideration.
Okay. And the debt remains as their responsibility, or does that? Yeah.
It so would, that, yes.
Okay. And as far as the ratio of debt, how much debt is acceptable for you for a business?
There's no quick answer there. Every single person is going to have their own scenario. And depending on the brand as a whole, we're going to look at everything. Again, like I said, like all of these metrics that we've just been discussing, they're all parts of the guardrail that go in place when we're evaluating the business. Not every single one is going to be perfect. So we're going to work with them. We're going to sit down. Our investments team, in my opinion, is world class. They're going to really understand the ins and outs of the business from a financial perspective, and then work with the founder to get to a valuation that both parties are very happy with.
Okay. But the key thing for sellers listening to this to take away is the debt remains as their responsibility. That doesn't get taken over.
Correct. Okay. And I also think that any sellers that are, you know, hopefully there's a ton of sellers listening to us right now. Anyone that has questions, they should reach out to us, right? We're an email or a Zoom or a Teams call away. It's mark@unibrands.com. I'm always happy to talk with any of these sellers and just walk them through exactly what we're looking at. Our goal is to be a great partner to founders, right? Whether they're ready to sell now or whether they're ready to sell in a year from now, we want to be here to support them, watch them grow, and be there to take the business on when they're ready to sell it.
So you can start dating some of these sellers that they may not be ready
100%.
To
100%.
100%. Because people don't know. You know, there is an interesting story. There is a gentleman, I forgot his name. His name was Norm. I forgot his last name. But he's actually an editor of the Inc. magazine. So what he did, he owned this, he bought this land in Brooklyn, in New York City, in Brooklyn, where it's in Williamsburg, and many, many years ago. And it was, nobody really cared for the area. So he bought this land and he built a storage, major storage. And then, of course, now that area is prime. So what he did, it is right by the river, by the East River.
Yep.
So perfect Manhattan skyline and everything. So he built this storage facility and then he wanted to sell it. So, but way before he was planning to sell, he went to one of the top players in the market. And he simply point blank asked them, look, if you wanted to buy a business, what are some things that you would like to see? Tell me what they are. And they mentored him. And they said, well, this is what you need, what business model, you know, what everything. So, of course, by the time he was ready to sell, his business was ready to be acquired.
Exactly.
So you are actually able to do that with some of the sellers.
I'd be happy to do that with the sellers. And if the seller comes to me and reaches out and says, hey, this is the brand I think I'm going to want to sell in 6 months. What do I need? And I see that the brand doesn't fit into one of our categories. I'm not only happy to like give them some advice, but also to introduce them to any of the incredible people that we work with who might be able to help them and take their brand to the next level. Again, our goal has never been, or the goal of Unibrands has never been, acquire as many companies as possible and grow them as quickly as possible at all costs. Our goal and our foundation is quality over quantity. So find the right brands that make sense for us, onboard them in the correct fashion, and then be able to integrate and grow and operate them so we hit those 20, 30, 40% milestones.
Great. So let's now talk about another favorite part of this acquisition aspect of it. The deal. So not the valuation. So let's say that you look at the numbers and then you come down to a reasonable number. So they're doing 22%, they're doing $7 million. And you look at everything, you took out the pieces or add on the pieces, salaries and whatever, and said, okay, fine. Your adjusted EBITDA is 2.1 million. So based on that, we are happy to offer you X multiple.
Okay.
So now comes the rest of the stuff. But what about the inventory they have? So how does that get? Because, you know, these sellers are carrying inventory. So when you acquire it, what happens to the inventory?
We pay the inventory at cost in addition to whatever the deal structure is that we're working out. And we always believe that if you have more inventory, that's better for us.
Oh, so it doesn't matter whether they are stocked up for 18 months. And therefore, so you are fine with that.
Yep.
And how about you mentioned earlier, the earnout. So as far as structuring the deal, give us some indications of what is something look like, what is more attractive, and so that they can expect.
You know, I would say typically, you could expect somewhere between 70 to 80% of the total deal value to be cash at close. followed by the remaining 20 to 30% to be broken out over the course of 1 to 2 to 3 years in some sort of stability or earnout mechanism, where if your if the revenue continues to grow, or if the the SDE grows to 10% or 20%, we will continue to pay out X or Y.
I see. So they have, obviously, they pick up something up front, but that they also get to benefit from the growth of their brand.
Exactly.
And when you acquire these brands, is the owner completely out of the picture? You take over, or do you keep them?
It depends what the founder wants to do, right? So one of my favorite sayings, as cliche as it is every brand is different. So every deal is going to be different. Some founders want to take their check and go sit on a beach in Bali. I'm all for that. I love that. I want that for them. Other founders want to sell their business and then still be involved and still help grow or come up with new product development ideas or help with the expansion going internationally. There's so many different things that founders could want to do, and we want to be able to provide that perfect exit to each and every founder. So we've had deals, as I said, where the founder has gone and is sitting on a beach somewhere and is like, don't ever call me again, enjoy the business. And then we've had, you know, quite a few founders that have actually joined Unibrands as full-time employees. And one of them or two of them actually happen to be our brand directors. And they end up owning a specific vertical within the Unibrands product category.
Mm-hmm. Because there are often situations where obviously they are operating their Seller Central account, doing things only in a way that they know. Uh-huh. So when you take over, you don't know anything as far as how they are operating. So usually there is a period where they are retained so that they can walk you guys through.
Yeah. So the way the process works is, you know, we do, I would say, a week or so of pre-LOI due diligence, where we rebuild the P&L, we figure out the right structure, we make sure that this is a brand that we want to move forward with. We then submit our LOI. And one of the things founders can take great pride in is that, and what Unibrands also takes great pride in, is we only submit an LOI once our investment committee has signed off on the price and structure. So assuming that in post-LOI due diligence, we don't find anything wrong, we're not going to try and retrade. We're going to stick with the price and the structure and the agreed multiple that we agreed on a couple weeks earlier in that said LOI. Then once you agree to the pricing and the structure, and let's say, Nick, that you're happy with what we offer, you sign the LOI, we go into exclusivity for 30 to 45 days. The first week or 2 weeks of that is continuing to finalize the numbers. And then the remaining 3 or 4 weeks there is starting to bring in our brand managers, bring in our supply chain, bring in our growth strategy team, and start to really work with the founders so that we understand the intricacies of the business. So at day 45, when we sign the APA and you hand over the keys, that's not actually day zero for us. We've already been running and working and managing the business for the past 30 days with you as a partner, so that we can make sure that nothing is missed when you exit the company. The integration for us is incredibly important, and we take a lot of pride in the entire process that we have doing that.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean that a deal usually from start to finish takes about 3 months? Is that how
long? No, less than 2 months. I mean, really? We've done deals in under 4 weeks. I think our quickest deal was just over 3 weeks. But I would say a deal is going to take somewhere between from first outreach to signing the APA between 4 to 6 weeks.
Wow. You guys work fast.
We're very diligent. We've done this quite a few times. And as I mentioned, our investments team is best in class, and the commercial side of our business is right behind them. We've spent a lot of time really building out our organization and making sure we have the right people in the right positions to allow us to be successful.
And does the size of deal impact the length it takes, or not really?
Not really.
Yeah. Okay. All right, cool. So there is plenty of opportunity for sellers. This is me, because I've had several aggregators on the show, and I'm going to ask you next. as an aggregator, how you are dealing with the current situation, you know, the current situation being, you know, rising rates and inflation and the situation with China and everything else. So it's not as busy as it used to be. However, obviously, there is still plenty of opportunity. So what is your strategy as an aggregator in the current environment?
So our strategy, so we go with the word strategic buyer, and our strategy has always been quality over quantity, right? Find the right brands, onboard them, grow, operate them, bring them to the next level. So when you talk about like what's going on in the market, for us, so much of our focus is on the existing brands that we have and making sure that we continue to grow and operate those successfully, which our team has been able to do throughout the past 2 years. So we have somewhere around, let's say, 24 brands. We are still very much actively acquiring. We are still very much looking for the next brand to onboard, and we're excited about that. Especially, we actually had an LOI go out a week and a half ago for a brand that we're working with. But so much focus right now is making sure that our organic growth continues to grow, and that we are profitable not only at the brand level, but also at the corporate level.
That's great. I mean, quality always wins over quantity.
Always, always. Look, there's our CEO's favorite saying is that it's not the first skyscraper to hit 100 stories that wins. It's the skyscraper that's still standing there 100 years later. And the reason it's still standing there 100 years later is because they took the time, they built the right foundation, and they continued to grow at a correct pace rather than trying to rush something to get to the finish line.
Yeah, I had some people from Thrasio on the show, and a few of them were on the show, and I had no idea, but they went to like 1,300 plus employees in like a couple of years. I mean, many, many locations, of course, around the world. I mean, who can handle a growth like that, right? It has to be very tough.
I'm not part of that team. I can't comment on any of their business decisions. That's not for me to say whether one way or the other. Coming from WeWork, I've seen the hyper growth. I've been part of that. It's super exciting. And it's a lot of fun. Unibrands is doing it a little bit differently, and I'm really excited to be part of this journey.
Yeah. So I want to ask you one of my favorite questions. So you are seeing these sellers. You mentioned earlier that 5 employees and then the rest VA would be ideal for you, roughly. Yeah. What is a good way for a seller to structure their team in terms of roles? So what would you like to see in a team structure?
Every single team is going to be different, right? You want to see a founder who's in the trenches with his sleeves or her sleeves rolled up, working across the brand and making sure that it's continuing to grow, that they're constantly coming up with new ideas or new ways to grow the brand, whether that be between growing onto a new platform or coming out with new products. I've seen people that have a VA that handles customer service, another VA handles all of the listings and the PPC, and going from there. It varies between every single brand. There's not one formula that fits everything, right? The reason that these founders and the founders that have been really successful is because they are living and breathing every single day their brand and making sure that nothing's going to go wrong. And they're trying to get ahead of anything they think that could go wrong. So the more that they understand, the more that they know, and the more that the knowledge that they could leverage, they're going to be most successful. If they start to outsource everything, they might not have control over everything, and they might lose sight for things and forget about certain issues that could come up and bite them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the people, ultimately, what I've seen is some sellers, the founders, are good at ideas and visionaries, and some sellers are good at process.
Yeah.
recruitment, managing the people, people person. So it all varies. But ultimately, what I found, especially with my clients, I tell them, look, first of all, there has to be somebody who takes ownership of the channel.
Always.
And that cannot be the founder, because the founder is busy chasing other dreams or products, making deals with supplier, whatever. So somebody has to be on the owner, and that ownership usually comes with ownership of the channel, comes with the responsibility for the analytics, how the numbers are playing out, conversion rates and replenishments and things like that. The other role is the paid advertising.
Yeah.
Usually that's outsourced. So I usually recommend outsourcing it while learning how you do it yourself, but don't try to do it yourself because you don't know. And
there's also a ton of agencies that are out there, as I'm sure you know, that can very much help with these things, right? That's I think there's so many entrepreneurs and past founders who saw what challenges people would have as they grow their brands on Amazon or Shopify or any other D2C platform. And they went out and they built these agencies to be a resource for these founders. And there's nothing wrong with a founder taking advantage of it. They don't have to do it all on their own.
Exactly. And then also the content is key. So somebody in charge of content, producing it, not necessarily the best thing in-house. You want to outsource that, but somebody has to know the essence of what kind of, because the content will ultimately drive your growth, your traffic, organic traffic. In addition, that's what's needed to get your conversion rates up.
So very true.
Yeah, so structuring the team. So Mark, my last question before we get to know you a little bit is something everybody laughs about. So knowing Amazon, dealing with many brands, if you could change one thing in Amazon's policies for third-party sellers, what do you think that would be?
That's a tough one. I think there's a lot of things. I think having more control of your inventory, I think would be, and more insight into inventory stockage and how much you can keep on hand at any given time. It would be probably something very helpful, right? I think supply chain is always probably the biggest hiccup for a lot of these founders, and would love to see ways to continue to make that a smoother process.
So you're talking about the inventory limits?
Yes.
So you want the limits increased, bottom line?
I think that could be helpful.
Okay. So, I don't know if you tried it or heard anybody use, but Amazon introduced this new service called Amazon Warehouse and Distribution.
Okay.
AWD.
Okay.
What are your thoughts about that?
I'm not as familiar with that yet.
Okay, so I don't know it myself, but I heard from one guest, I forget now, yes, it was an agency. In fact, I forget his name, but and his episode hasn't aired yet as we record this in January of 2023. But what he said was one of their strengths as an agency was to implement some of the new things that Amazon releases. And cited AWD service, and stands for Amazon Warehouse and Distribution. So that was the first time I heard from him, and I Googled it afterwards. But AWD was created primarily for this very reason that you're talking about, and also to be used as a 3PL if you don't have one. So
interesting.
What that does is, I don't know if they are setting it up as competition to wipe out these small 3PLs. I doubt very much, but there are the dynamics also, maybe moving in one direction. But it's primarily for you to use AWD to store the bulk of your stock, and then you can call it off into FBA as and when needed. The only thing that I don't know, I'm not sure about, is if that replenishment is automatic.
Just interesting. Like
fulfilling the FBA orders, they don't ask anybody.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm gonna do some more research, and on our next podcast, I'll come back to you with it.
Yeah. I'd love to hear, because you know, life becomes easier for logistics is the hardest part of this business. So
of course,
I always tell sellers, you know, at the beginning, everybody wants to be selling. Your only concern is selling. Don't worry about selling. Your biggest challenge in online sales is not selling. It's the supply.
Staying in stock.
Yeah, because that comes with many challenges. For example, finance, right? So if the stock is available, you need to buy it so that it's in stock all the time. Knowing how much you ought to be carrying without bleeding yourself dry. Yes. That's the biggest challenge, and there is no solution for it off the shelf or otherwise. You have to build your own. And so I always say, focus on inventory management, focus on replenishment. You get good at that, then you don't have
to worry. You'll be okay. I very much agree with that, Nick.
Yeah. Okay. This was great conversation. Well, I'm going to title this episode, Breaking Down the Value of a Brand.
I appreciate that. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So now let's get to know you a little bit. Yeah, because I want the listeners to know who they were listening.
Of course.
So tell us, where did you grow up? What was your beginning, so to speak?
Yeah, so I'm proud to say that I'm born and raised in New York City, in Manhattan. I grew up right near the UN and the Queens Midtown Tunnel on 40th and 2nd. Lived there through college. Ended up graduating from Hunter College on 68th Street in Lexington. So really always stayed close to home and absolutely love the city, and I'm very proud of it. Grew up in the advertising world and ad sales. Kind of think of Mad Men, but on the sales side, not necessarily the creative. Was super addicted to that. Went off and got my MBA living in London. Ended up working for a financial institution for about a year and a half, and realized that was not the world I wanted to be in. It wasn't for me. Came back from after living in London and Thailand. Came back to New York City. Worked for another ad agency, and it was fun, but wasn't where I saw myself long term. Ended up going to WeWork and was there for just over 6 years until I found Unibrands.
Cool. So what I want to know is, because your pattern is to be in sales.
Mm-hmm. So
what is attractive to you to be in sales?
So the thing I love most about sales is not only speaking with individuals on every single day, but it's being a problem solver. Right? Like, I'm never selling something. I'm trying to solve someone's problem. And the problem that we're able to solve at Unibrands is providing the perfect exit strategy for every single founder. At WeWork, it was providing founders or entrepreneurs a place for them to work where they could continue to be creative and enjoy being around like-minded individuals, right? It's never about just selling one thing. It really is always about solving someone's problem.
And where did that come from? Why did you get into this problem-solving mindset?
I think it's really exciting to just be around people and see what they're going through and see how we can help them. And it's not therapy or it's not anything like that, right? But there's people need things throughout their career in order to continue moving forward. And if we can help be a part of that, then that's really exciting.
Because this requires a somewhat analytical approach, right? So breaking down things to figure out what is the need that I can address, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's about asking questions and doing your due diligence and, you know, doing the outreach to the right people that might be interested in having that problem or have that part solved that they need, right? Now you can look at you said there were 600 plus brands on Amazon that were run by 400,000, give or take, sellers. Not every single seller, I mean, of course you have Amazon Basics, but not every single seller is also going to want to sell their business. So that's totally fine too. They don't need to sell their business, but you have a large portion of founders out there that do want to sell their business. And if Unibrands could be there to provide them with the great exit strategy, let's figure out how we make that happen.
Sure. So I'm still on the problem-solving mindset. So usually, you know, these things come from our experiences growing up. So in your family, were they in business? They were business people or engineers?
They were business people. My mom grew up kind of, or my mom worked for a bunch of different financial institutions. And my dad was third generation in a hardware store. So he was always working with people, helping them fix whatever they needed in their apartment or in the factories. He was there to kind of provide them with the tools and the knowledge. And I got to watch him do that. And that was something that was really cool for me to see and to witness.
Did they used to take you to work?
I went to the hardware store my entire life.
Really? So you were working there almost?
I was working there from 10 years old until we sold the store and turned them into restaurants.
So, I mean, you were working with tools and things that people use. I mean, that's the essence of problem solving, right? So you were
I would say so. I've always been doing it. Got to learn from the best.
So it's they condition you for this kind of environment.
Very much so.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to figure, because, you know, it doesn't come natural. Like some kids are, they're in the clouds, or they like sports, or, you know, every kid is different.
Of course.
It's the whole environment that they grow up in. It kind of conditions you. So
I very much agree.
Because engineers usually are, because I'm an engineer by training, so I'm always breaking down things and analyzing. And so I was trying to see but working in a hardware store totally doesn't.
Very, very different, but it's helping people.
Yeah, I mean, you did the best part of it, in the sense that, first of all, it was a business, was about making money, but at the same time, it was working with people, figuring out. So this was great. So, Mark, this was great. The information was especially valuable for many sellers. So share with us, you already shared during the recording, but give us your contact information. How can people reach you?
Of course. Mark, M-A-R-K, at unibrands.com. It's UNYBRANDS, Mark at unibrands.com. I'm always on my email, for better or for worse. And anyone out there that's listening, I'm happy to chat with them and understand their business, see what they want to get out of it, and see if we could find a way to work together.
Great. We'll put your contact information together with the episode, so whenever it's published, we'll be there. And anybody else, I encourage you to reach out to Mark, whether you are looking to sell or one day looking to sell.
Yeah, or if they know someone that wants to sell. We got a great referral program as well.
Oh, great. Great.
Perfect. Thank you, Nick. Mark. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And this brings us to the end of another episode. And I'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure and subscribe, rate, and review our show. And be sure and share an episode with a friend. And thank you so much for being with us today. We'll see you next week here on Amazon Legends.